you get just a little bit more excited when you're talking shit about a band. I swear to God, you do. It's just a little bit of like, ooh, I get to unleash. I get to unleash. So who did the 500th episode? Were you the host?
Yeah, Vivian Campbell.
I read.
Guitar player for Def Leppard.
Oh, yeah, it's neat. It's neat.
Yeah, I've been after him for a couple of years, and I eventually got him.
That's cool. Hey, Martin.
Yeah, how you doing, Joel? Wow, Viv Campbell, that's awesome.
Yeah, I got it. Good job. He lives about 50 minutes away from me now, Martin, in Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Cool. Right.
Very
on.
Cool.
Excellent.
Martin's favorite. Well,
good,
yeah, right? Def Leppard.
Good seeing you guys. Yeah, exactly.
Throw it in early, get the jabs in before we begin.
Yeah.
All right, here we go. Yeah. I'm going to give you guys a hard time. So here we go. Martin Popoff is a Canadian music journalist, critic, and author. He's mainly known for writing about the genre of heavy metal music and is a senior editor and co-founder of Brave Words and Bloody Knuckles. He's written over 85 books that both critically evaluate heavy metal and document its history. Martin recently released a trilogy on the band Rush titled Limelight, Anthem, and Driven. Those books knocked mine down the Amazon bestsellers list a few notches, so I figured I'd call him to come on the show to give him explain to me personally why he would do that to me. To help me beat up Martin, I invited Richard Waddell. He's originally from Ireland's oldest city, Waterford, and that makes him tough. Richard started co-hosting the Focus on Metal radio show 8 years ago. And as a fan, I'm happy to say they just passed episode 500. The episode features, as we just said, a full career chat with guitarist Vivian Campbell, by the way. So my first question is to you, Martin, and I'm wondering, what do you do in all your free time? Because 85 books basically means you write a lot. So to preface your answer, I'm very close friends with Michael Grace. Michael wrote Poltergeist, Cool World, and I consider him a real writer. And he told me in the get-go, never write for more than 4 hours a day, ever. And I wonder, do you have a rule?
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. I'm a morning person. I'm usually kind of working by 6:37 in the morning. I start to fade around noon. I need a nap a little later. All my best work, I mean, I totally agree in that whole thing. You know, when you hear those business people talk about do your A priorities first and your B priorities second. And when your brain cells are all gone, then do the C priorities. So, you know, it's not hard doing this many books when it is your main job, because most people who write any books at all seem to have other gigs that they're busy doing as well. So it takes them, you know, a lot more time because they're spreading it out over a lot of time. So, and I suppose you got to write fast as well. I mean, that is a prerequisite to get a lot of books out. I actually changed my email signature thing. I was shocked. I thought I got to add this up because, you know, my mom's telling me, oh, you must be over 90 books now, eh? So I went and added them up again and it's 108 books now.
Your mom wants to be proud. Look, she's like, what's up? It's not even 100. What did I do?
My dad gets on the ski lift with total strangers and starts telling them about me. So mom always kids him about that. So, but he's quit skiing now because he's 82 and his knees are gone. He just quit this year.
So does mom read all your books?
No, nobody reads anything, but they watch the YouTube videos and stuff, right? I go on with Pete at Sea of Tranquility and stuff, and they watch all that and our show that we do ourselves, The Contrarians. And I don't think they've ever listened to the podcast, even though I'm up to 198 episodes at this point, but not like Richie, of course. Richie's
I was going to say, Rich, are we
in that field?
are we amateur hour to you? Are you guys?
No, not at all.
Watching a football match right now? Are we wasting your time?
No.
Anyways, that's the deal. I mean, it doesn't take that long, really. I mean, when it's your full time job.
You know, before you jumped on, we were chatting about Danny Zalisco. Zalisco? I'm going to bring him on in a bit. We're going to chat about his book. And I used to know the questions because Richard read the book, and so he knew the questions to ask. And I would know when I did these interviews if they had read it, because they only ask questions about Stone Temple Pilots. And that's because it's in the second part of the book I get to the other stuff, and I know they never brought it. They never got that far. So you can tell so quickly how far they got in the book. But I think it's kind of fun. So what's the kookiest book you would like to write? Are you into crochet or something that would blow us away where Martin writes a book on, you know, Air Supply was my favorite band. It's all a lie. I mean, what do you got?
Bigfoot. I've been watching a lot of Bigfoot stuff lately and listening to a lot of Bigfoot podcasts and reading Bigfoot books. And I just love that stuff. I love all the high strangeness stuff that goes on with Bigfoot with the weather and UFOs and people disappearing and orbs and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I watch a lot of paranormal stuff too, and listen to a lot of paranormal stuff and read that stuff as well, which kind of led into a really weird book that I did that is the kookiest book I ever did, this Flaming Telepaths, Imaginos Expanded and Specified, which is probably more of a paranormal book, an occult book and paranormal slash than it is a Blue Oyster Cult book.
What was your first book? Should I know?
Well, it was this self-published record reviews book called Riff Kills Man, 25 Years of Recorded Hard Rock and Heavy Metal. So it was 1,942 reviews and self-published it. And then the second book, I think, was when that got picked up by a publisher in 97. So that was 93, started Brave Words in 94. And then 97, we did the official book.
So that was the one with the, it was funny. I typed you in, you know, what comes up. So Def Leppard, they made it a big deal that you gave them nothing, but it's funny because I wanted to do a coffee table book at some point with like some of the worst lines in music history. Cause you'll sing the songs and you don't necessarily think about what they're saying. And the one I love with them, and the first tape cassette I bought was Hysteria. So, but I clicked the link that was on what is the song actually about? Pour Some Sugar. It was a broken link. And that was the first one on Google. So that was funny. But do you take sugar, one lump or two? And as a guy who's attempted to write some music, I wrote a song for Darius Rucker. You couldn't come up with anything better than that.
And then you're in our car. Song lyrics, it never works, right? You get the newscasters on doing that in their newscaster voice sometimes, you know, making fun of really violent rap lyrics or something like that. And you can make any lyric sound funny, but Def Leppard is also the ones with, I suppose a rock is out of the question, right?
Now, Martin, I know you're not a fan of Hysteria at all. Yeah. But one of the things I remember listening to that record when it came out, sometimes Joe Elliott would be singing something. I didn't know what he was saying, whatever way he phrased these words. Did you get that at all with Joe at all?
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing that bothers me about Def Leppard. His voice is so kind of wheezy and it sounds tired all the time. And then they load it up with the backing vocals to the point where it doesn't sound like human beings anymore. And yeah, I don't know. I hate being down on them all the time, but they really are. It's kind of like in that same field as Bryan Adams. And I don't know. I just get no value out of anything they did after those first three albums.
Mm-hmm. Joel, you would have gone on the road now with a lot of bands in the 90s. Do you remember many of them loving the 80s rock at all? Or were they like,
I thought you were going to leave it right there.
Pleasure?
I thought you were, do you remember any of them? And the answer was going to be like, no. Well, it was so with Poison. So I did the Glam Slam Summer Jam. And it was the one I did was Poison, Warrant, Quiet Riot, Enough is Enough, actually, which you guys talked about in one of your things. And we had a lot of people float in and out. One of the bands was actually the Turtles, which was one of the things I had read that you said in an interview recently, Martin, is you're not a big concert goer. And truth be told, I'm not either anymore. I prefer to sit in the luxury of my
house. What were all your duties? Like, what did you do?
So it kind of depends what tour. So on Poison, I was a lighting guy. And I hated lighting because the problem with lighting is you set the lights up. It doesn't mean they're going to keep working. And I'm on a Poison band, you know, at the time they were like park hands. They wanted it to be like the 80s. So the entire rig is just a bazillion of them. And I'm up there focusing them all every day. It's a good workout. And honestly, for a kid, it was kind of fun. And then before the show, something's wrong and you got to climb up there. You think you're all neat. Everybody's looking at you and you're like, eh. You know, I got it. But I think that that was the biggest 80s. Now, I wasn't a big 80s music listener. I was a big STP fan because I had just come off the road with them. And I I thought they were the bee's knees. When I began to tour initially, I was very excited about the Chili Peppers. That album, Californication, was just, it was so huge. It was all around us. It was everywhere. STP, I knew. I had done that club where you get 12 CDs for the price of one, and one of them happened to be that first album. And I had listened to it a bit, but watching it live was a different experience. And I understood the bravado of Scott. When you're looking on the side of the stage and you have Ozzy repeatedly watching their entire set, something special, you know, Howard Stern, always every chance you get, and you feel good. The Metallica guys, you know, they're sitting there. It's an opportunity. So you feel, you begin to look around you like, A, I'm lucky. And B, this is something special, isn't it? Cause these guys have been around the block a few times. They don't need to watch this band. And so Scott, I think, was an amazing frontman. Yeah. And that's actually one of the things I was hoping to ask you, Martin. You know, is there a book on STP that might come one day? Are you a fan? What did you think of them as a band?
I like them quite a bit. I don't think there would ever be a book on them. I've interviewed them in person, a couple of them, Eric and Dean, I guess, together. At this one hotel in Toronto. It was pretty neat. So I got to go to do that. And then I got all my stuff signed. So I've got, you know, some stuff signed by Scott as well. I remember I went to another press conference and I stumbled into the bathroom before the press conference started. And Scott's standing at the mirror working on his makeup and stuff. So that was a little awkward. So, but no, I mean, other than that, I might've had a phone or two, but essentially I'm too old to get enough interviews with those guys. Plus they're really hard to get interviews with. I don't know. They're kind of antisocial, the guys that are alive even, right? They have this wall up around them. It's a little bit like, I don't know. I over the years I've noticed that, it got harder, you know, I'm saying this and I've got some Styx interviews coming up, but over the years, it seemed that Styx got harder to talk to and Hart has always been hard to talk to. The Cult guys have always been hard to get interviews with. And I remember in the 90s when we had Brave Words, it was funny. It seemed like Ozzy was going to be like no problem to meet in person, to talk to do phoners with. And then all of a sudden it kind of stopped. And it's like, man, years are going by. We keep getting told no, that we can't get Ozzy anymore. Right. So you've got to strike when you can with these bands, but STP, I just feel like it just feels, and I don't even know for sure, that it's a little bit like pulling teeth, trying to ever get those guys on the phone for anything.
Mm. Joel, can I ask you a question on that? Because you were on the road with him for many tours. Did Scott do all the interviews?
So I did one tour. But to be honest, I wouldn't know. And I wouldn't know because I'm on the stage. So when the bands are gone most of the day, usually, I assume they're off doing interviews.
They all did them, I think, and they're all good too. I mean, Dean and Rob are like musicologist dudes. They love music, right?
So they love talking about it. Robert's first concert was Rush. That was his first show that he went to. Dean obviously led Zeppelin just to the. I say it in my book. He would sit with you, and he'll just start playing Zeppelin, and then totally change it into an STP song and smile at you. You know, so. They learn from the good stuff, but they're quiet guys. I think they would. Eric is definitely an introvert, so having him in an interview would be interesting. I would think you'd have to push pretty hard. He's just a quiet person. Period.
Dean's kind of rock starry though, right? Dean's got some swagger to him.
Dean for sure.
Yeah,
for sure. Did I say Dean? I meant Eric. Yeah, Eric.
Well, you said Eric was quiet. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, no, Dean for sure. He loves being that guitar player.
But they hated being called grunge. Eh? They just couldn't stand that. Right. That really drove them crazy.
Rock, man. We're a rock band. We're a traditional rock band. It's just a few of us. And they were the thing. I think Scott gets a lot of clout, but as a collective whole, they were all really good musicians. They knew their craft, and they never did sound check. They would only do a sound check if there's a film crew or something for promotion. They wouldn't bother. They played together so many times, there was nothing really to go over. The whole big deal was like, hopefully Scott doesn't go on a bender and we finish the tour. That's always what mattered. You know, see what happens every day. Is everything good? Everything's good. Let's go. So, but he was good that tour. And I've heard the stories, but I never had any issues. He was very nice to me. He treated, but I'm 20. 2 years old. Wow. So I'm a little, I'm a little guy. And I mean, they're big blokes. They don't mind fighting. They're pretty tough. So they kind of took me under their wing. They would give me a hard time, give me noogies, you know, that kind of thing. They were good to me, but I worked hard and I cared. I cared a lot. So, yeah, it's just
Martin. What did you make of that talk show record, the one they did without Scott?
It's pretty good. I don't remember it now, but everything they did was pretty good. Velvet Revolver is kind of underrated. I mean, Velvet Revolver fell under that Audio Slave sort of super group or sick of super groups thing, right? But yeah, the talk show record was fine too. And that press conference that I saw was a Velvet Revolver press conference. And then we went down to the highway and saw them in Hamilton. And I had to sit down in person with Duff and what's the name of the guy, the non-famous guy in Velvet?
Dave Kushner.
Yeah, so it was Duff and Dave. And I'll never forget though, sitting there interviewing them in this, you know, in this ante room kind of area at the Hamilton Hockey Barn, right? And you know, it's a carpeted place. And Duff just turns to his left and just like spits on the ground. It's like, oh, okay, well, that's interesting. You know, we're having an interview here and we're in a carpeted room and he spits on the floor, right? So I don't know.
Okay, so here was a question. I kind of jumped into it. I don't remember who I was talking to, but they did an interview and they were interviewing the rock star guy and he's eating dinner. And he said the problem, he's like, you know, pass the mashed potatoes while I'm doing my interview for my 15 minutes or whatever time I get. And his daughter keeps getting up from the table and she's wearing like a cut line shirt. And it was very hard to focus on this interview. So for both of you guys, have you done an interview where you're kind of like, what's going on here? You know?
Well, I remember on the food thing bothering Ricky Rocket, not Ricky. I got to tell you something. So I was pulling out 45s and CD singles today to come up with an episode of Contrarians. And I had some drywall stuff done in the office. So there's drywall dust and I'm pulling this stuff and flipping through them. So my throat is kind of closed up and my head is not working properly right now, but, Bobby Dahl. I remember being backstage in the eating area and bothering Bobby Dahl for a couple autographs. And he was a little ticked off while he was eating sort of thing. But,
I was told it's hard to get them on your show. Have you ever interviewed any of them, Richard?
Any of Poison? No, none of them.
It was really hard. I'm like, I don't know why. They're all super easy to talk to, all of them.
Yeah. Yeah, I love Ricky and Brett. And yeah, I mean, CC, you know.
CC's one of my favorites.
You know, and they were all very personable every time we, got to see them. So during those tours that you were talking about, I mean, that's when we actually, I was not a big Poison fan in the 80s at all. But I got to once I was charmed by them and albums like Hollyweird and the extra songs on Crack a Smile and more and on Greatest Hits, that's when I became a Poison fan and getting to sit down and interview them and stuff like that. It's like, okay, well, I kind of like these guys, you know, but in the 80s, I just couldn't get past the productions and sort of the simplicity of it and very Americana feel. So certain hair metal things kind of rubbed me the wrong way. And I never got on board with certain hair metal bands and loved many other ones.
Worked for them on that Greatest Hits album was Richie Zito produced it. And it was one of my first jobs. I was a runner for Richie and Richie was such a pain in the ass, man. He had like a, you have to fill out the crap about getting your cell phone and he didn't like the way he had written it, how it looked. So he made me go back to like AT&T to get the piece of paper so it could look better. Like you're just mailing it in. So that was like my big, and then it's funny that I got to work for Poison years later, but CC's a musicologist. This dude knows his stuff, man. He really, really knows music.
Yeah.
And so he was always really fun to chat to. I think he should do more interviews and stuff because he's an interesting guy.
Hmm.
He's a good guy.
I think one of the things about CC that I've heard over the years is he's unfiltered. He just says what he feels and that gets him in trouble.
Yeah.
A lot of people. But yeah, I would totally. Yes.
Punk rocker. He's a total punk rocker, right? He's the Dee Dee Ramone of the band, right?
Yeah. Yeah. He's a neat guy.
The Ace Frehley of the band.
So I've got a couple albums that I love. There's probably more, but that I like to listen to every few months. I'm a big Pink Floyd fan. I know Richard is. We talked about it earlier today.
No, I'm not.
But I am. I think Animals is their best album. Martin had just done this book on Animal on Pink Floyd. And I had listened a lot, and I've ended up really loving the Animals or Animals the most. And listening to that album regularly, I feel like I hear new things every time. The other thing I was looking up is I love Thick as a Brick. And I couldn't find anything you had said about Thick as a Brick. Are you a fan?
Who, me?
Yeah. Well, either.
Yeah, I love Tull. And Thick as a Brick is probably close to my favorite. I think I like Heavy Horses maybe a little more. Mm-hmm. But Thick as a Brick's great. I haven't really written much on Tull anywhere, but I've gotten to interview Ian a few times, and he's great, and Martin Barr. But I've just never had any, you know, they do so much on their own, and they talk so much, and they've done massive, you know, essays in all their reissues, and they've got their own books out and all that kind of stuff. I don't think there's ever going to be a Jethro Tull book from me, but you know, one way I thought of getting to write about a bunch of that stuff is the trick of, you know, I've done these over the years, these top 500 heavy metal albums of all time. And then, yep. And then I reissued them as the top 250, blah, 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 heavy metal songs. So I have had it in mind on the back burner to take the big poll, find out what the top prog albums are of all time from a poll, and then write reviews of all of them. And that's one way I could get to writing about all of these prog albums. Thick as a Brick, I guarantee you would make the top 12 or 15, you know, on a poll like that.
I just love how I hear different things on an album I've listened to so many times. And I love that it's just really one track and two bits, but it's one track. It just keeps going and going and going. And they only did two takes. Which I thought was really kind of neat. So are there albums that,
too.
Pardon?
Beautifully recorded too. For 1972, I think it is. It's really sounds good.
It is. Are there albums then that you are the same or you like to listen to, you know, often? It's some.
Well, you know, there are albums that I just go back to all the time involuntarily, like Clutch, Blast Tyrant, and Manic Street Preachers, Everything Must Go. The Damned, I keep playing over and over again all the time. I just constantly going back to those records, playing a lot of Jam. XTC, I keep playing over and over again. From that list, you know, so it's not a lot of, I mean, ZZ Top Rhythmine, I suppose, Tejas, but most of, you know, most of the stuff that maybe I'm associated with having done a book on or whatever, I'm so sick of it by now that, yeah. that I'm not, there's a lot of things that are, you know, can't be qualified for going back to because I'm just sick of them. Right.
Little break. What about you, Richard?
Well, my sweet spot is probably 86 to 91 because I was 16 and 86.
Right.
So I always kind of go back to that era. But lately what I've been finding is I'm listening to a lot of one band's catalog. I'm in a big Queen kick at the moment. I'm listening to a lot of Queen. And then in a couple of weeks' time, it could be Sabbath. And then, it might be Ozzy. And then I might go back and I might listen to Def Leppard. Or it all depends on me, really. But lately, I've been, like, I pick out three or four albums from a band, and I'll just listen to them for, like, 3 or 4 days.
So I do the same. I had a Pavarotti kick. And we, my girlfriend banned Pavarotti. And people come over like, how could you ban Pavarotti? She's like, Pavarotti, day and night, a whole week, he wouldn't stop. And I'm like, I like Pavarotti. So I'm going to set you up. I'm warning you, Martin. I'm setting you up. But there, you got the warning. So this is a quote from you. I can find it on my piece of paper here. Metallica's S&M album. Note to Kamen. Stick with the bland, boomer, easy-listening diva stuff. Having your lame army of librarians duke it out with the majesty that is heavy metal reminds me of flabby CEOs buying designer Harleys, born to be mild.
Yeah, I would stand by that. That all makes sense. I've never liked a single one of those classical things by anybody in any genre. I just think the whole thing is stupid. So to me, it's about the songwriting. Like, writing the songs is way more important than anything. It goes on the record. After that, it's the band playing them live. And way down the road in unutilitarianness is the band playing with a bunch of classical guys. I just don't care in any way. Hmm. And I remember describing it once. I think it might even be in that review, or because the Metallica one comes to mind. But sometimes these classical things sound like you got two radio stations competing right when the signal's going one way or another, and you're hearing strings doing whatever they decided to do to be clever. They're a little atonal or dissonant and counter to what the band's playing. It's all dumb. I don't like any of them.
I agree with Martin, because I think the only time it works with Metallica is to call it Cthulhu, the instrumentals, where there's space in the music. A lot of the Metallica songs, like Damage Incorporated, they're fast. There's no room for the orchestra. You're trying to fit something in that doesn't fit. And the only other songs that really worked, I think, on S&M were the ones that they wrote with the orchestra in mind. The rest, I'd never listen to that album from start to finish again. I probably listened to it once, and I didn't even get the second one.
But I'm more philosophically conflicted or against the idea of, here's the band, here's the songs, here's a whole bunch of strangers playing along with them. Like, that's the whole thing. I you know, if they were playing guitars or kazoos or whatever, I kind of have the same feeling. It's just like, you're a bunch of interlopers. I don't know what you're doing here. There's the songs were perfectly good the way they were. Now they're just worse.
Mm. Martin, how did you feel when Jimmy Page and Robert Plant went out then with all the African instrumental players?
Again, you know, nowadays you have to think of that a whole new way, because nowadays it's called cultural appropriation, right? Mm. So nowadays it looks even more like the rich white guys, you know, slumming it with world music, right? Now it's like, oh, you can't even do that probably. You know, that's the weird thing about it. But back then, I still don't think it's all that great a thing. I mean, it's good. It's good for guys to write absolutely brand new tunes with, mm-hmm. with whoever and collaborate and have a collaboration that's cross-cultural. But there's no point taking Led Zeppelin songs and bringing these guys on to do it. So I don't know. I love, by the way, I'm one of the only people on earth who thinks Walking into Clarksdale is a masterpiece. I think that is literally, I people just think I'm nuts when I, you know, I rate that in the list of Led Zeppelin albums, and it's literally like third or fourth. I just love that thing. To me, that's the lost Led Zeppelin album. So yeah, loved what they did on that album. Mm. Mm.
So what did, in your research and stuff, what did Michael Kamen do for The Wall? What was his, what did he lend to them?
I don't remember. Is there a bunch of strings on there? I just literally don't remember. There's a whole amazing book where Bob Ezrin is interviewed to death all about The Wall. There's a lot to know about The Wall to figure out what's going on. But when I did that Pink Floyd book, you know, those books were, that whole series was literally find a bunch of as famous people as you can, and yeah, and or deep fans, and interview them and do a Q&A on every studio album. So it was kind of a nice thing, because I was literally just the interviewer in all those books. Yeah. And the most amazing thing was getting Paul McCartney to talk about Queen one. Yeah. So that's the top of the food chain right there. That blew my mind to be able to talk to him.
What did he have to say?
Well, he was great. I mean, I made sure they were softball questions, you know, about Queen. And I think he did it because him and Brian are kind of buddies, and they share, you know, animal rights, causes. Yeah, he had some good stuff to say. And I asked him a few Beatles things as I went along, but I made sure the questions were softball questions. And, you know, with a guy like that, I said, you know, I just want him for 12 minutes, right? You come up with a number that's really short and say, you know, I can make this really short. But the neat thing that happened was he was driving his own car back from the studio, making that amazing studio. Which one was it? The one that doesn't fit in your CD case. Yeah, there it is. Memory Almost Full. I think that was the album he was working on. I love that record. It's so good. I mean, all this stuff is really good. I mean, he's very underrated as
I loved that Egypt Station. All those years.
Yeah.
That Egypt Station album, I listened to it a lot of times. Yeah. I thought it was fantastic.
But so he says, "Oh, Martin, you got me. I'm a captive here. I'm driving my own car back from the studio," right? And which was amazing. So I talked to him, and I actually called off the call after about 25 minutes because I didn't want to overstay my welcome and have him say, "Martin, get off the damn phone. You know, I don't want to talk to you anymore," right? So eventually I called it off. Pudding. Right? But you know, one of the cool things that happened as I could tell, as he got closer to his home, whatever that is, he says, "Hang on, Martin, I'm driving up a little country lane and there's a woman in front of me." He's going, "Back up, love, back up." So he's stopping for this woman who's stuck on his country lane probably and like to get out of the way, you know. So you could hear him just driving home from the studio and getting closer and closer and more rural. And then there he is at home. So no, it was great. And yeah, I kept him pretty softball, and he, you know, his knowledge of Queen, you know, you had to keep it softball. He wasn't like a deep fan. He didn't know everything, but he did say one thing. He had a Gween, a Japanese tribute band. He hired a Japanese Queen tribute band for his wife's birthday when they were in Japan. So they had Gween play for them.
You should have just said, "Ishmael Lachna, do it. Come on, Paul, do it.
Yeah. So I got to ask him a couple, you know, heavy metal-ish type things about Helter Skelter and stuff. And I've used those quotes in a few different books to say, "Hey, look, I talked to Paul."
Martin, do you know, has Brian May and Paul McCartney ever shared the same stage?
I don't know, and I can't think of a single time that would have happened. So I don't know.
They can't either.
Some sort of animal, you know, animal rights cause thing that they did together, but no, nothing I can think of.
Yeah. So here was my setup, and I was hoping you would know better. So I got something to show you guys. When I picked this, you know, I'm a memorabilia dealer. Martin and I had talked about it. I don't think I ever told you, Richard, but
no.
So I do a lot of music and film memorabilia as a profession. So I have this.
Wow.
It says The Wall, but when you open it up, this is Michael Kamen's complete.
Wow.
This is his complete handwritten sheet music. Jeez. To the entire album.
That's crazy. Wow. That is nice.
Martin's on the next flight down to see you.
That's why I texted you, Richard. Like, hey, I hate him. I'm like, well, this is going to be a, you're going to be a little bit down. But yeah, I was intrigued to know.
So do you think there's more in there than actually showed up on the album?
Oh, this is what I'm after, right? So there's so much written in, it's hundreds of pages with coffee stains and eraser marks and all the good stuff. And
I can't picture a lot of, I can't picture where all these strings are in my head right now.
I can read through them, but I mean, there's like The Wall Prelude is just pages and pages and pages and pages. It's the strings, it's the horns, it's everything. But,
so where did you get it?
Where?
Yeah.
So I go to auctions on a regular basis. And when I show up to the auction, it's not necessarily great because the people in the room, including the auctioneers, are wondering why I came. And so I'll have people, I'll ask people to bid for me. I'll pay people to bid for me or whatever. So if it's under 10 grand, there's a pretty good chance you won't see me. So they're wondering why I came, and they'll start looking through everything in the rooms to see why I'm there. So if I spend too much time looking at something, lo and behold, it's removed from the room. Other people, they'll bid against you, and then they'll figure it out later. So I'll buy stuff to throw them off my scent on a regular basis. Anyway, I'm at the auction house, and the auctioneer, he said to me the day prior, "Hey, Joel, what's this?" And I thought it was a photo album. And we open it up, and it's all sheet music. I'm like, well, you know, before computers, you need to write it down. But I kept thinking, it says Kamen, M. Kamen, and it says Roger Waters. And I started thinking, why do I know that name? And I think I knew it because I think Kamen, Michael Kamen had something to do with November Rain. Am I right, Martin? I might be off. I think he did. And so, I don't know.
It was Queensryche.
It was Queensryche.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did that.
Silent Lucidity.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. But I... what do we think about that song? It's funny, actually. So to jump, I'll tell you the rest of the story, but to jump a bit, I listened to that thing with your friend where we go through the albums you like, and I'd never heard of Sabotage. I'm not a big metal listener. So I listened to it today I thought it was fucking great, man. So thank you very much. Because when that whole The Mountain King came on, I'm like, ooh, you know, this is, now we're getting into it. And then it's just followed up by that Price You Pay. I'm like, this is a good album. This is very, very good. And so I don't know. Thank you for lending me into that. But the next one that came up, because it's Spotify, Afflicts Through the Songs, was Silent Lucidity or Queensryche. And I'm kind of like, well, that was a drastic change. It's kind of like, I think the album's over. I don't know. It just happened there. So it's funny how they do their algorithms and stick things together. So the hope is, what I want to do, I had a fellow come on the podcast who's an incredible, his name's Kenneth Crouch, and he's one of the best piano players in the world. You know, what's funny is about a lot of the musicians you'll talk to and you'll bring on the show, they don't read music. And so they wouldn't know better than you or I. So Angelo Moore from Fishbone, I know well. And I showed him, he could care less. He was like, Richard, he's like, whatever, well, Pink Floyd. But he couldn't read anything. He wouldn't know what he's watching. Dizzy Reed, he wouldn't know. He didn't read music. So this guy, Kenneth, could read and he wanted to. So I'm hoping to maybe bring on some guys like that and then maybe bring on some fun guitar guys like a Steve Stevens. He's a fantastic player, to start breaking down the sections. But what I want to know is, I want to know that creative process.
But why not get actual string people in, because that's what it is, and just get that literally played from the book? It's like, that would be really interesting to see how much of it actually matches up with the album, right?
I'm so intrigued. And then the stuff, you can see the pencil marks. So a real trained person, why did he erase this? And they'll be like, well, it correlates to this later. And he obviously switched it, but initially he was doing this and this and this. It'd be very interesting. You know, you could... So at some point I will, I'm just trying to put it together and see what to do. And, you know, it's a big thing. I learned years ago from a guy named Dennis, who's an antique dealer and a jack of all trades, memorabilia dealer. He sold some incredible things. And you know, what do I keep and what do I sell? And he said, you sell everything. You don't have anything good enough to keep. And I'm like, you're an asshole. You know, and years later, it's the best advice I ever got. There's only the top one. The Van Gogh is worth keeping. The rest of the stuff, you don't need it. And so I sell everything, but this is my one percenter. This is neat. I happen to love Pink Floyd too, but this is my top thing that I haven't tried to sell. And I'm just trying to do the best avenue for it. And not just for me, for everyone to see the differences of what this guy added to it. And then, you know, I'm presuming he was hired by Roger Waters. I know that he did it in New York while Roger and them were in London recording the album. So why did they hire him? What happened? You know, they did the Pink Floyd guys. I don't know who specifically wanted to know if I wanted to sell it. I don't right now, but I'm having fun with it, I think is the quick answer. Neat. And so at the auction house, what happened was I show up, I start buying stuff. They don't know. And the item comes up. And before I preface it. So I called around the day earlier and I called my friend Brian Chaney's. He works at Profiles in History. They're really well acclaimed as an auction house. And I said, the R in this is very similar to the R in Michael Kamen's letter I found online. And he says to me, I think it's just an R. I don't think you're really, sorry. I write to michaelkamen.com and the guy's like, that's Michael. Who are you? Then you shut up, because it's not too hard to find out what auction's coming up tomorrow in LA. And you call in and you bid whatever and you ask them to pull it and you look. So I don't say anything. So I buy the item and I run up to the thing. And when you've been going for a while, you can say market delivered. So I grab it and I don't want it to go into the back. I want to take it and I want to put it. So the auctioneer guys looks at me and they're like, fuck. You know, they're like, well, what was that? And I'm like, this is the wall. this is it, buddy.
Wow.
We're just kind of like, shit, what did we just do? You know, what did we just do? And everybody's kind of looking at me and it was cool. I buy a lot of posters, old posters. I sent them to Nico Lowry. I got a little plug for Nico at Swans. Nico's a really great guy. He's on the Antiques Roadshow. And the big poster is this turn of the century poster. And inside of it is a receipt. And the receipt, the person on the receipt was Michael Kamen's manager, who had passed away recently. That was the chain that made it all make sense. And it's just really neat. It's just something I take pride in. So that's why I was setting you up, because it was like, what do you think about Michael Kamen? And it's like, oh.
That's wild. That's really,
yeah, you're wild. The first guys that have ever seen this. I've other than sending it to the people putting the exhibit together, I've never sent photos to anybody ever. So not that you got a very good glimpse. It is on a Zoom call.
But I could see a big swanky opening party with like a string quartet in the corner playing that whole book, right?
It would be a magical experience for a guy like me. I would sit there just in all glory. What about like a Joshua Bell, you know, just going through the whole thing for, I mean, just, it's a neat thing to talk about and to have, and maybe something a little different for you guys too. I don't know. So I thought it'd be something fun to bring in there.
Yeah. Wicked.
Yeah. Wow. So on that note, what albums do you dislike that everybody would expect you to like?
Ooh. Well, I'm not a big Pink Floyd fan.
Earlier.
I like Prog.
That was pretty good. We only talked about it for 10 minutes or so. Martin, though, maybe Martin and I will get together and do something. But I thought it was pretty funny. How could you hit? So there's no albums that you find palatable?
Floyd. Not really, no. I tried Animals. I tried all the early stuff. I like some of the songs, but as a band, they just never grabbed me at all. I think everyone has bands that, you know, they just, for some reason, they don't feel it.
Yeah.
That might be massively popular. Like, I don't like The Doors. I've never liked The Doors either.
Yeah, so Martin's obviously Def Leppard there. I'm not a big U2 fan, so sorry.
No, I like some of their stuff.
I've got a good one for this answer now that just came to me.
Tool. What do we got?
Tool is a band that I'm supposed to love. Everybody's supposed to love. We're all supposed to respect the hell out of them. I've got all their stuff. I was semi into them at the beginning around Undertow and all that kind of stuff. And then the albums got even more classic and more amazing. And you're supposed to love them to death. And I would play them and I keep trying to get into it. And I just couldn't get past the geometric wall of the slide rule music they were making. Right. For some reason, just couldn't absorb those Tool albums.
You know, funny. I swear you get just a little bit more excited when you're talking shit about a band. I swear to God you do. It's just a little bit of like, ooh, I get to unleash.
Yeah.
I think it's eras of bands as well, because you're expected to like a classic era of a band. Like I've spoken with you about this before, Martin. You're a bigger 70s Rush fan than I am. I love 70s Rush, but I'm a bigger 80s fan, especially Grace Under Pressure, Power Windows, Hold Your Fire, and Presto and Roll the Bones.
I love
when you're more Signals than before that. People can't understand. I can't believe it. Like, how can you love that era of the band and not the era that everyone else loves? It's more an era thing than a band thing for a lot of bands. Yeah.
See, I'm the Final Cut. I listen to the Final Cut more often than a lot of the big Pink Floyd albums. And then I love Roll the Bones. I really enjoy it. All right, so Tool, I do like Tool a lot. I love that stuff. What do you got, Richard? What's your band that you should totally dislike?
That is another one.
Radiohead. Radiohead's one for me too.
I'm not a big Radiohead fan. And see, people like they assume you love Radiohead because you love Tool, but no, I'm not a big Radiohead fan.
Wilco, I know nothing about Wilco. I'm supposed to love Wilco, right?
I don't like Nirvana.
Hmm.
I love Soundgarden, Alice in Chains. Never got Nirvana at all.
Hmm. I love all of them. All the big grunge bands, love them all.
I did too. I did like them. I mean, Nirvana had the place for me where we just all, you know, I was big Rage Against the Machine. I loved Rage Against the Machine. Mm-hmm. And actually in my book, that was the time I spent was on that chapter the most, because I wanted to make sure it was written in a way where it would come across great. Cause I really did. It was neat to watch them perform. I thought they were fantastic. So again, with Pete Pardo, and we do this thing with albums you guys do, which I really enjoyed. I watched a few of them, and you guys pair so well together. You're a great team. It's my one compliment for you here today, as I've been beating you up maybe. But I had a moment where I wanted to listen to One Hit Wonders. And I wanted to know, how bad were these other songs that Dixie and the Midnight Runners could not have a follow-up hit when they were that big? And out of it, I punched up a list to say the biggest one-hit wonders. And it was funny because a couple of them were bands that I really love. One of them is Blind Melon. I love Blind Melon. Yeah. And that's on the list. In fact, when I first listened to my Dizzy Reed, I called them. I'm like, what the hell? I was like, well, how could you not have told me how good they are? You know, Shannon Hoon played with your damn band, for crying out loud. You know, how could you never inform me that I've missed out on this great music for so long? And I went on a Blind Melon spree for weeks. But some of the other ones listed, Twisted Sister, totally don't agree with that, because they had a couple big hits. I think I like Twisted Sister a lot. Inagata De Vita, Iron Butterfly.
Yeah.
Gary Glitter, that was the one that. Yeah. Rat is on the list, Round and Round. And I heard, Martin, you're a big
man. They're not a one-hit wonder band.
I love, I thought they were the great, unsung, complicated, sophisticated, awesome, smart hair metal band. Like they, like early Aerosmith, that's a band that basically always turned in a good album. They always tried super hard and everything sounded great.
You know, they used to play a lot because I'm in LA. I grew up here. And so they used to play off of Sunset all the time. And I saw them play so often and they would always give it their all. Like you said, you know, they made an effort and they were fun. That was the thing about Poison. That's what I had to learn when I went on the road with Poison. I was a snob. You know, I really did. I shaved my head every day on stage in revolt against this long hair bullshit. And I turned around quickly because there was a lot of boobs. But yeah, take your hat off. Enjoy it. They're not trying to be Led Zeppelin. Brett's never said I'm Led Zeppelin. It's an enjoyable experience. So do you have the ability to do that? Just to listen to an album and enjoy it for what it is.
Yeah. What other one hit wonders you got? This is
Soul Asylum was on there.
Yeah.
I know you're a fan of
Train.
Yeah. And then I think I stopped. A lot of it then was like poppy stuff, rap songs. A lot of rap songs was on there. The Macarena, I'm like, you know, I figured as a kid, you know, I figured these poor one hit wonder guys, they really wish they could have been out of this category as VH1 played it every single day of the one hit wonders. And you always knew it was going to be Aha was the best video. And Nirvana or Aha was always the best video. And the one hit wonder was always Dixon the Midnight Runners. But I don't know. How bad do you think they felt about it? I think they probably did okay. Now as an adult, I think it's a feather in the hat. I think
old days, Brownsville Station, Smoking in the Boys Room would fit. Looking Glass, Brandy.
Oh, yeah.
You think of the semi-early nascent yacht rock things like Starland Vocal Band, you know?
There's a lot of 50s stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of 51 hit wonders because they were churning them out. They were cruising with all these guys. So
yeah, but Joel, are all those one hit wonders only in the US? Because some of these bands might have had multiple hits in the UK.
So like Chinese Democracy, this big flop, he spent 13 million, blah, 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 blah. It wasn't a flop. And on an international level, it did well. You know, they liked it. It did not flop. Just, you know, they'll say like, you know, now we're going to beat up on America a little bit because you guys aren't from here. But actually, I was born in England, so I don't know. Hopefully, I don't get beat up when I go outside. But they'll say, you know, when I traveled a lot, I'd backpack around or whatever as a kid. And they say, you know, you Americans, you think America's the whole world. And I'd laugh and be like, no, we don't. We think the city we are from is the whole world because we've never been to any of the other states either. You know? And then they'll do these things where they'll tell the other world, you know, where in America is this or that? And I'll be like, ask any American where Poland is. And they couldn't tell you.
Beat up
on my country for a couple minutes there. So, yeah.
That is true. That is the thing that a lot of people think about Americans. They just don't know enough about the rest of the world, right?
Well, I'd be quiet. I went through Egypt. And I get off the felucca and I'm in this little village with no water. And, you know, this is back in the mid 90s and there's no water. There's no electricity. And the guy comes up to me and he goes, Monica Lewinsky, Bill Clinton. And I'm kind of like, oh, my God, you know, where are we at? But I would use my English passport and I just would shut up. I just wouldn't talk. And then they don't know where you're from. I'd pull the Stone Temple Pilots guys. There you go. I'd be very quiet. And then you just don't say anything. But a lot of Americans like I'm Canadian. But Canadians don't sound like Americans. You know, they put the Canadian flag on your backpack and everything's good here. We're safe. So yeah, it's funny. I used to hate the Australians because as I traveled around, actually in Egypt, they'd be like, this guy's American. And then I'd get shit on by everybody. So for a minute there, because of it, all my friends were Aussie. And so we'd go out drinking beers. And after a bunch of beers, what do you think about the Aussies, Joel? I'm like, I hate the Australians. And I'm just surrounded by Aussies. But a lot would happen with the Irish. I toured with the Cranberries. And I mean, dude, you know, we'd get really drunk. And
oh, yeah.
That was, You know, you guys, you're under your football. You mean it so much. They'd get up all hours of the night. We do load in at like 7-8 in the morning or whatever, 8-9 in the morning. They'd be hammered, blitzes from the night before because they've been up all night watching. Mm-hmm. Wow. So, and then that's why Martin won't go to concerts because he knows. He's aware they've been drinking the whole time.
No.
What do you think about pairing? So like, I like Tracy Chapman a lot. And Dolores, and they did that album actually with Pavarotti. So what do you think about pairing musicians like that? Have you found it interesting, or does it go into the same vein of bringing in these artificial elements that are unnecessary?
Richie, it all depends on the concept. The person you're bringing in has to be able to pull it off. Like if it sounds completely out of place, you're just going to go, it's unlistenable. I'm not going to listen to it.
So, you know, I remember that Chieftains album, and they brought in a bunch of people, and one of them was Mick Jagger, and they did the Long mm-hmm. Black Veil. I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah.
Really fit.
Yeah. Some of them work and some of them don't.
Yeah.
But so I generally have like, there's a ceiling of interest that is pretty low because I just want to hear that band
who
have stuck together and have gone through all this. And I want to hear the context of those four guys and the 10 records they did before it all together. To me, it's just confusing. It bothers me. You really see it in hip hop these days, right? I mean, everything, you can't even read and figure out what the band name is because it's this F-E-A-T dot this guy and this guy produced by this guy, you know, the remix by this guy, and you lose the plot after a while. So you see that so much these days, but I'm usually not caring at all. I just want to see the band.
Like myself and Martin are huge King's X fans.
Yeah.
And all those three guys keep coming out with all these different projects and solo albums, and they haven't done an album together that been released in 10 years, and it's like just doing album together, a King's X record. That's the other stuff is good, but there's that magic when the three of them get together and release a record. So that's what we want.
Yeah, I'm Sisters of Mercy. I love the Sisters of Mercy. So when they come out, are you a fan, Martin?
No, I've tried all that goth stuff over the years.
Interview's over.
Yeah. Well, you know, as a sort of angry metalhead who is into various things as you get through the 80s and you try all these bands, them and Mission and Lords of the New Church, it was a little overrated for what it was. I mean, I loved having those three Lords of the New Church albums, but and you know, the graphics and everything looks really cool on Sisters of Mercy and Mission stuff. But, you know, you play it and it's like dancey and the production's thin and it's not heavy and you wanted it to be heavy. So a lot of that stuff just kind of fell by the wayside. Bauhaus was always sort of casual sounding, never into the Birthday Party or Nick Cave. That's another one we're all supposed to love who I try every once in a while. And it's just like, too many albums, too many universal music styles he's into, right? Most of that goth stuff, I mean, I wish I liked it more, but it just doesn't come across. I love Stranglers. I love The Cure. I just want some effort put into this stuff. I don't want EPs, you know, I don't want covers, you know, those goth guys. Yeah. They made a lot of EPs, didn't they? And a lot of live stuff. And it's like,
So were you this opinionated when you were a kid? Was your mom like, eat the mashed potatoes? I'm like,
no, I think it was worse because we were such metalheads, right? We were just like, if it wasn't heavy, it didn't count for anything. And we mathematically would go through albums and call each other up and go, it's a 7 out of 10. It's a 7 out of 9. It's a 5 out of 6, which means it had some so-sos. It actually has 10 songs on it, but we had a whole formula worked out so you could just tell your buddies what an album was. It's a 5 out of 8. You know, with average goods, really good, so-sos, lousy goods, lousies. That was our rating system for everything. I mean, I could probably remember and spout off 200 albums, like what they were, you know.
Remember, it's like,
oh, yeah, it was bad. Yeah, it was a little bit like that Exodus Paul Bailoff thing you hear of, right? Like, you know, Posers Die, right?
It's worse when you get a new album that comes out. You're all excited and you listen to it and you're like, oh. And then you listen to it again, like, I missed something. Let me try again. And then you listen to it a second time and you're like, that one sounded okay. Let me give it again. And you're trying so hard to love it. But every now and then there is a breakthrough where you're like, oh, I'm actually warming up to it and you like it. But I think I said somewhere else, this is why I think everybody in music sticks with it. It's the same idea as being that little kid and getting that album in your hand and going like, I get to listen to this again. Yeah. It's a fantastic feeling. It's a neat feeling. So a bit of fun one. You said it a few minutes ago, and it's kind of like a roadie thing. How come people say that they're going to see a show rather than go to listen to a show? And you said it when you go to see a show. Why do you think that is?
Richie, take that one.
That's a good one. Because I always go...
It's the only good one I got after that.
I always go to see it and listen. I don't think I've ever put a phone up in the air and watched it through a video screen. You know, the way people all put their phones up now, I don't think I've ever done that at any show. I always go for the whole experience. I want to see it and I want to listen to it. I don't want to document it on a 3-inch screen and then put it up on YouTube. I'm just not a fan of that. I want the whole experience.
Let's live in the moment. It's
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'll give you a good answer for that one. Why you say you go see a show? So here's what I would think, because obviously I've never thought of this before, and it's a pretty strange question. But so because the listening to the show is competing with the record back home, which sounds way better than it's sounding here. So all of a sudden, on the sound end of things, this is super inferior to what you always listen to, because you always have control over the bass and the treble and the volume. It sounds great in the car. Probably everybody's car is the best stereo they own, believe it or not, right? But the vision, the seeing it, is absolutely as good as it can ever be, because it's not fuzzy, it's not distorted. They're right there. All the lights are on. So the seeing is super, super impressive. But the listening is not very impressive, and it's already competing with something you have better at home.
Yeah, I wouldn't argue with that. And that's why I like to listen to something and close my eyes and drink a beer or have some tea or something and just enjoy, take it all in. When you're at a show, there's other stuff going on always. And
You know, one from a roadie point of view that always bothered me is we blew them off the stage, or we played lousy tonight, right? And it happens, it's the exact same answer and question and weirdness and illogic that I think when a hockey team or a basketball team says, we play lousy tonight. It's like, well, okay. So when you say that, do you mean you personally played lousy, or did your whole band by a super coincidence all play lousy tonight? Did all five of you sound terrible tonight, and you sounded and like, oh, you all sound great every other night when you say we killed it? It's like, okay, so who's hung over here? Who's in a good mood? Who played lousy? It would be very
What odd. Was her name? And how many hours were you awake?
Yeah. And then how did those four guys blow you four guys off the stage? And you know what? They're the support band, so they all came to see the headliner anyways. So I don't think they blew you off the stage. All of that really, really bothers me too. Like that whole collective, we played lousy, they blew us off the stage, blah, blah, blah.
So the blow off the stage thing, we gotta go. So I did a couple ones. So it was the Turtles with all of these metal bands. I have no idea who booked that, but I was so happy to see something that wasn't metal, because I'd been touring with Poison for a while. And the Turtles were very, very good, by the way. They did a whole historical deal on what their band had done. And it was really fun. The Blue Man Group opening up for Godsmack. That was a bad one. what the hell was the promoter thinking there? These guys made it through their show. They were the Red Man Group by the end. They were bloody, man. People threw everything they could at them.
Wow.
And it's Godsmack. It was mean. But then, but sometimes you're kind of like, who's up? Black Sabbath, Ozzy Osbourne.
Yeah, the bills can be different, but the other part of this, can you really all be better than the other guys who are all bad? Is you have songs happening over time, so it's like, did they blow you off the stage with song C versus song D of your set, and like. When you went down and played something off the new album, sure, maybe the lull was, but just like to collectively say somebody blew somebody else off the stage. And every fan out there has a total different opinion of why they're there and what kinds of songs they want from both of those bands. There's so many variables that it's just odd to think that
well, Martin, that was anyway. I think that was one of the things you addressed in when you did the Black Sabbath FAQ book. There's this wide-held knowledge over the years that Van Halen blew Black Sabbath off the stage in 78. Yeah. And you tried to contradict that, saying that wasn't necessarily completely true night after night after night.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you know, I guess thinking back, I mean, I don't know what I said at the time or if I'm, you know, who I've talked to over the years about that. But again, the logic of the situation is a little bit like Van Halen might have been more energetic every single night than Black Sabbath, but the crowd is there to see Black Sabbath. They don't even know who Van Halen is. So there's a ceiling on how much they're really going to like this new band, you know, who are playing before their heroes. And these guys have done nothing with their lives yet. And Van Halen and Sabbath's now on their eighth album. So, you know, they're there to hear those Sabbath songs and those Sabbath songs get done. And it's not like they're falling off the stage, like Aerosmith having a punch up and they fall off the stage or whatever, and they can't do anything. It's never going to be that bad. Right. Maybe Ozzy's not singing the greatest or whatever, but yeah, exactly. That's the kind of thing. It's like, no, it's not entirely possible that all these people who paid to come see Black Sabbath, suddenly they don't even like Black Sabbath anymore and Van Halen's their favorite band.
I will say that there was one band that I saw in 92 and they opened up for Megadeth on their Countdown to Extinction tour. And I'm a huge Megadeth fan and Countdown's one of their best records. Mm-hmm. And they blew them off the stage was Pantera. Oh, Pantera just released A Vulgar Display of Power.
Wow.
And yeah. I had the album, I think, was probably out about a month. And they were absolutely incredible. Megadeth looked pedestrian and they were too polished, where Pantera had this raw energy. They were just coming to their peak at the time. They were hungry. They wanted it. And you could tell. And even though they only played for 40 minutes, I still put it down as one of the best sets of songs live I've ever seen. They were amazing.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's important too for the fan. Yeah. You're looking at the best bands in the world. It isn't like one of them sucks and one of them's good. You're watching the best musicians there are. They made it through the cut. Mm-hmm. So soak it all in. And one of the best things everybody loves about Detroit, they love music. Actually, one of the things is Toronto. So there's a place called The Warehouse. I don't know if it's still there. It was such a fun place to watch a show. It was a great little venue. It was really neat. And the fans were enthusiastic. They were happy. If you had an off night or something was going on or whatever, it was okay. It was okay. Yeah. It was a fun experience.
Yeah. And, you know, Richie, to your point, it's like 50 to 100 of those people thought Phil was just screaming a bunch of noise, right? I mean, bring us Dave. Dave's a great singer. Phil, this guy's an idiot. Look at him jump around. Oh, look at his hair or whatever. Their music is a bunch of noise. Like, there's a whole lot of people hating them too at the same time, right? So that's the point. Everybody in their head has got all these different factors going on. And it's just, you know, there really is no super trend to the whole thing. And the other thing that bands do that will turn a crowd against them is if they look like they're not having fun and they don't want to be there and they're like admonishing the crowd or they're not happy with the level of applause or they didn't sing back and they make some crack about them or whatever. There's all these little things that cause a lot of damage to that show that will turn the tide, right?
Joel, yeah. you must have seen that. A band say something on stage to the crowd.
Oh, yeah.
So Scott was famous. What Scott would do, you know, you ever been to prison, little boy? I have. I'll make a man out of you. He would say that all the time, you know. And he would he must have watched. This is interesting. So you're that good of a front man in my head. And yet you're noticing all these things with the audience. The audience, when you're on the stage, is just a big mass of stuff. It was hard for me to like individualize people. Yet he would see if guys were groping a girl. So a girl would hop up and start cruising through the crowd. He would watch them if a guy was groping a girl who started crowd surfing, he would stop the show and start, "You ever been to prison, little boy?" It was always the same thing. And then if he felt like it, he would jump into the audience to go kick that guy's ass. And then, yeah, it would change the whole show. You're sitting there waiting. And then Dean and Robert don't have a problem fighting either. And they're big boys, man. So all of them, Dean, I remember, I think some guy spit at him. And he jumped in the crowd to beat the shit out of the guy. Remember, Dean was a construction worker before he started doing this. These guys are tough, dude. And I don't know if the crowds realize that, like, this guy will hit you. So those things would absolutely happen with STP. And then Axel is famous for getting angry and stopping the show. So I didn't see that happen, but I was fearful of it in Rock and Rio. They were saying, you know, there's 270,000 documented people there. And they were like, "So we have an issue. You need to go to the helicopters," and the helicopters are over there. But you're looking at 270,000 people right there, looking at a bunch of helicopters way over there. And you're thinking, like, I don't know.
You're like Arnold Schwarzenegger in Predator, get to the chopper.
That's what I said in my book. I'm like, get to the chopper. And all the security guys did not laugh at all. They just kind of looked at me. And I'm like, all right, well, it's a serious thing. But I thought about it. I'm like, I'll just throw my walkie-talkie on the floor and I'll be like with the front row. I'll be like, "Yeah, Guns N' Roses, we're coming after you." And nobody will know the difference. And I'll just blend. But I thought about it for real. I did. I thought about it. You don't know what could happen. And then you have the atrocities, the things like Dimebag. When you realize those things can happen, but you can't live in fear either. There's a lot of things that could happen. But That one was scary. I think that was brutal. So yeah, stuff, you know, so one thing, not to change the subject on poor Dimebag passing away, but Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, what's your overall thought of it?
Richard, want me to go first?
Sure.
Right. I'm from Ireland. When you get outside the US, Hall of Fames mean nothing. It's really a US thing. If I love a soccer player, I think he's a great player. If I come to America, that soccer player, they'll say, "Is he a great player?" And then they always add in, "Is he a Hall of Famer?" We don't do that outside the US with anything, really. So the Hall of Fame actually means nothing to me. I don't need someone in a building in Cleveland to justify what I listen to say whether it's good or not. That's the way I see it. I've interviewed a few musicians and I've tried to phrase it that way to them. Like Glenn Hughes was one of them. Like Glenn is from England. He didn't really take the bait. He gave the politically correct answer.
Yeah.
Because they have to.
They have to.
There's only a few musicians who'll come out and say something against it. Like Bruce Dickinson from Iron Maiden was one of them over the years. He's always said that he's not really interested in it. And then you've got other musicians like the Eddie Van Halen. That didn't even show up for it. Like they just didn't respond to getting the award at all. But to me, I'm not like, say, Eddie Trunk. Eddie Trunk is always rallying on about the Hall of Fame, disrespecting metal. To me, it doesn't mean anything to me personally.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a huge hater of the thing. I mean, it gives us something to talk about it, and it's interesting how it works. I suppose the one thing that I like about it is that everybody has tried to do this kind of thing so much over the years, and at least it's got some kind of traction so that involuntarily by osmosis, whether you argue it up or down or whatever, it actually does mean something out there in the world. Like, I mean, it does get discussed and it is kind of a bit of a hubbub when it all happens. I mean, Steve Miller really exposed the whole money flows of the whole thing and how it's just all about money kind of thing. That's too bad. But I think the one thing I don't like about it a fair bit is this whole weird idea of Judas Priest getting nominated and then like next time they might get nominated again, or it's like, well, you got nominated, you didn't get in, and now you know you've lost your strength. It's like, to me, doesn't your strength go up when you're nominated? Like that means, hey, you should get in for sure next time. But no, they have this kind of weird thing like, well, you didn't get in, now you're off, you know, you're off the plate or whatever. So that's weird. The ebb and flow of being nominated and not getting in and stuff. But, and, you know, I mean, over the years, it does, you know, there is a little bunch of people and you're kind of happy for these guys getting in and not them. And you can argue about one and then next year they come up and stuff. I guess one reason I've softened a little bit on it is A, like I say, it's gotten traction, and B, most of the bands that I think are at the top of my list that should get in, kind of eventually they do get checked off and they do get in. You know, it's kind of happening a lot. And when people start bringing up bands that are some of my favorite bands and their favorite bands that should get in and stuff, that's when I go like really kind of like, I say, look, talk some sense into it. I mean, they don't get in now. They might get in 5 years from now or 10 years from now. But even I, who love this band, don't think they should be in.
But what's happening as well, Martin, these bands have been eligible for a long time. And
yeah.
They're getting up there in age, and some of them pass away, and then they get in, like Deep Purple.
Yeah, that sucks. Yeah,
John Lord passed away, and then they got into the Hall of Fame. So they're waiting way too long.
Yeah,
to put them in there,
and it still has the singer songwriter Avocado Mafia, Rolling Stone bent to it, right? Critics Darling bent. So there still is that. But a lot of, you know, it is pretty interesting how many of our hard rock and heavy metal heroes are showing up, at least for nominating, and then some of them do get in. So I mean, it's not the Grammys, right? It's not that kind of a travesty where I just hate the whole thing completely. And like, none of it makes sense to me. The whole Grammy thing, nothing makes sense to me about it. But the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame at least feels somewhat anchored in reality as you go through this whole thing. But yeah, it is weird, you know.
Have you been there, Martin?
To the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Yeah, a few times, yep.
Because
it's not far from here. Yeah, it is. It's a really fun place to go. I mean, it is a little bit like a smaller version or more broken up into a number of things, like this Pink Floyd that's coming, like the David Bowie that had happened. I love that. I went to the David Bowie thing. I was there for 2.5 hours. It was a long time, right? Getting through that whole thing. There's a Rolling Stone one. Rolling Stone's coming to Canada soon. So the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is like 3 or 4 floors of 3 different themes or bands, like whatever, for this, the, you know, limited amount of time. And they do a great job of it. I saw a Clash one. I remember a Bruce Springsteen one. And then they've got the standard stuff that's there all the time. Yeah, it is. It's a fun, interesting thing to go look at. And it's kind of neat that it is in Cleveland because it gives Cleveland something, right? And it's not far from here, but it's so Cleveland became a little bit of it's a kind of a place we'd go once in a while. You know, with Brave Words, our magazine put on a couple festivals in Cleveland, and I like the Browns. I want to see the Browns win. So it's kind of cool.
That's interesting. I mean, it is true that I think you'd be hard pressed to go through there and not find something you thought was neat. And for me, it was John Lennon's report cards when he was a kid. Maybe silly, but I don't know, for whatever reason, I thought that was kind of neat. I know you're not a Doors fan. I'm actually not huge, but Jim Morrison, he excelled in English, you know, things like that. And you're kind of like, oh, if they only knew. He wrote some good lyrics. So I think it's a good way to look at it. Cause my initial opinion is what you said, Richard. I don't quite understand it. If you have a baseball Hall of Fame or whatever, they do it off of numbers. This guy had X amount of years. He hit ERA said so. And so he deserves to be in because he's at the level that we've already established is great. But with the music stuff, where are we picking these? What hat are these names coming out of? And then Jay-Z is rock and roll. So
there's that whole thing too. Pop, hip-hop, country, singer-songwriters, legends who maybe only made a couple albums and they weren't even all that famous, but they're legends from the early days. So there's so many factors, you're right, that throw.
So I have a friend, he's an Irish guy, and how come Thin Lizzy's not in the damn Hall of Fame? He's like, this is just so stupid. And he's so mad. He was mad. He was very mad. I'm like, well, because they weren't doing a re-release of a Thin Lizzy album this year. That's why, my friend, you know. And he's like, yeah.
Well, that's one of those that I think like, hey, eventually, but over what I'm seeing on this list, I they're one of my favorite bands of all time. But I like talk people down on Facebook and say, look, no, compared to this list, then Lizzy doesn't deserve to go. No. Compared to,
but it is true. I mean, it gives you a way to discuss, to exploit, to why you bring them up out of somewhere you haven't talked about them in a little while. It renews interest and energy. So I think that's a really good way to look at it. I like that.
And I've written these articles for, I did a big one on Yes. I did one on Judas Priest and I did one on Deep Purple for Goldmine Magazine about here's the reasons they should go in the Hall of Fame. Right.
Have you heard of all those bands, Richard?
Two of those went in, right? But Priest hasn't gone in yet. And I think, you know, what are the top of your guys' lists? Who are the three bands that aren't in that you think are the ones that should be in the most?
Me? Lizzy for sure.
Who Judas Priest, Iron Maiden. Yeah. And Lizzy.
I'd put Priest and Maiden at the top of my list.
Yeah, definitely. 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 Yeah.
The Beatles?
Yeah. Jethro Tull is not in yet though, right?
No, I don't.
Yeah, so I think they should be in too.
Yeah, I do. I love that album. What was the, so Martin was a drummer at some point. And what was the name of your band, Martin?
Torque.
Torque. Okay.
And in school and in second year university, we had a university band called First Inversion. But Torque was our main band. Is that all the band names I'd come up with? Yeah, I think that's about it. Yeah.
We're going to have a book on your
band? Iron Maiden letters, right? We had a big banner behind us and all that stuff. Yeah.
Good. Well, all right, guys. Well, unless there's anything, Richard, that you're pressing to bother Martin about here.
Well, I do have one thing to show Martin.
Oh, what do we got?
Martin. There you go.
Yeah.
So, okay, you did the three Rush books.
I got all three of them right here. There we go.
And they did. They drove me down the list. Thank you. we got to get Martin writing that book on. Well, it wasn't Crochet. What was it? His mom's mashed potatoes or whatever. And then I'll do better again. But
I'll do a Bigfoot book. Actually, Driven, for the first time I saw it, it showed up on the Canadian nonfiction list at number 9 for sales. That's the first time I've ever seen a book actually on a sales list.
You know, one interesting question for me, maybe it's on a more personal level, but so with Danny and there's a woman I'm going to bring on, her name's Tana. She's we talked about it. She's doing a book too. So she had a publishing deal. He didn't. I do not. I didn't look for one. You've gone through publishing deals, but you self-release some. What are the major differences? What do the publishers do for you?
Well, I mean, in most cases, the publishing deals are better than the self-publishing, but sometimes the self-publishing is better. And sometimes the self-publishing is even better than, like, if you get a real good seller, sometimes they can be better than even a pretty, really good, you know, publishing deal. So I've had every size of advance from $0, you know, up to, I don't know, kind of the 10,000 range. So I guess the main thing the publisher does for you is if you do get a big advance, you kind of do get a bunch of pay, irrespective of how it sells, and you get that pay pretty quickly. And you don't have to worry about the layout and all that sort of things. And often getting, you know, you have less things to do if you do it that way. But honestly, I mean, in most cases, you know, across all 108 books or whatever it is, I would say the pay works out the same no matter how you do it.
Interesting.
You know, but the pay on the self-published stuff is you're printing it in like the low hundreds, but you're making $20 a book. With the publisher, you're making $1.50 a book, right?
Well, Amazon takes a lot too. They take,
well, yeah, and I don't give any of my self-published stuff to Amazon because all I hear is nightmares about how they just beat up everybody and you don't make any money.
You make no money. On my book, I make zero, but I wanted it to be more accessible. I didn't really care. I didn't do it to make money. So, but yeah, they push. And then the audiobook is the biggest one. I think my audiobook, we just released it. It's like $20. I mean, and there's no cost. They just email it to you. It's zero. And you're not allowed to choose the price. They set it. There's nothing you can do to decide what you want it to be.
Yeah.
So, but that's why Amazon's so big.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Well, guys, I really appreciate you taking the time, and it's very fun. It's good to see the two of you guys. Yeah, it was fun. That was a cool little chat and stuff. And I feel more learned. I was intimidated by you. I'm like, I don't even know what to say to this guy. But I knew once I bought up
Sabotage. I'm intimidated by both of you guys, believe me.
And I figure once I bring him Sabotage, he'll be really nice to me. I'll just tell him I really loved the album, and he'll be like, this guy's a class act.
Right on. Well, thanks. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
Till next time. Sounds good. Here, I'll push the end button, but you guys can chat. Hey, thanks for watching Party Like a Rockstar. If you're not already subscribed to the Facebook or YouTube channels, do it. We're also on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. The handle is Party of Stars. Thanks for watching. You'll see you next time.